For July 26th, 2017, this is the Energy Transition Show with Chris Nelder.
American coal.
Nuclear energy.
Natural gas. Hydro.
Solar power.
Wind turbines.
We're becoming a monumental exporter of natural gas.
This boom in the United States is not a bubble that's going away.
The oil's still there. I'd rather pump it from another country and save ours, and then when the rest of the world runs out, hey, guess what? We can still turn on our lights.
We've run into a problem where we have constraints, where there are limits now.
The new phase we're going into, related to the exhaustion of these resources, there's no replacement. This is a one-shot affair, and we're unprepared for it.
Really, we do not have very much more time to get a handle on this problem.
It's better to get to a renewable future, a sustainable future, sooner rather than later. Get there before we do the environmental damage, not after.
When the night shows, the signals grow on radios. All the strange things, they come and go as early warnings. Stranded starfish have no place to hide. Still waiting for the swollen Easter tide. There's no point in direction. We cannot even choose a side.
Welcome to the Energy Transition Show. I'm your host, Chris Nelder. This is our fourth episode in our mini-series on climate science. So it may seem a little odd that we're only now getting into the science of the carbon cycle and how it relates to warming, because how carbon is released into the atmosphere, how nature captures and recycles it, and how our activities are overwhelming the capacity of the natural carbon storage cycle is the core of the global warming phenomenon. But teaching about climate science isn't easy. Experts like Dan Kahan have shown that one's political orientation can distort our reasoning, and no amount of factual information can overcome that. Daniel Kahneman has shown that the things that we think we know intrinsically, like the things our tribes believe, can lead us astray, and that overcoming that part of our minds requires an intentional focus and a lot of mental energy. Scientific facts can arouse all sorts of resistance if those facts are at odds with our institutions, or our tribal beliefs, or even, by extension, our identities. For this show, I elected to follow the thread of news headlines and politics into the subject because in these ever-so-political days, that seemed like an accessible approach to the core science. But there are other ways, including just persisting with teaching the fundamental facts of climate science and working through the data to come to some useful and policy-relevant conclusions. But even doing that requires a good deal of personal fortitude and internal balance. Teaching about climate science in the era of the Trump administration is certainly no easy task. Our guest today is an expert in teaching climate science and knows a thing or two about how people learn and what the effective teaching methods are. Dr. Sarah Harris is a 2015 3M National Teaching Fellow and Professor of Teaching in the Department of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. She has a PhD in oceanography from Oregon State University and a research background in paleo-oceanography and paleoclimate. She is the co-author of a 2014 book titled Understanding Climate Change, Science, Policy, and Practice, and she offers a self-paced free online course called Climate Change, the Science. Her current research explores how people learn climate science, and she has a very elegant way of presenting the science of the carbon cycle. Then, in the news segment of the show, we'll have a look at an exciting new transmission line project for Norway, how Norwegian companies are switching to electric propulsion for ferries, an encouraging report on global coal usage, more news about coal in India, and how investment houses are rebalancing their portfolios in light of new information about coal. But first, our conversation with Sarah Harris. So let's bring her into the conversation now. Welcome, Sarah, to the Energy Transition Show.
Thank you.
This is our fourth episode on climate science, but actually we haven't really talked that much yet about the carbon cycle and the pathways that greenhouse gas emissions take into the atmosphere. Now, this is a scientifically literate audience, so I don't think we need to cover the very basic concepts, but why don't we just start with a refresher? How exactly does the carbon cycle work and produce warming?
Well, really, the warming part is really about how much carbon is in the atmosphere acting as greenhouse gases. So the two main ones there are carbon dioxide, which has C in it, CO2, and methane, CH4. Both of those have carbon in them. In terms of the carbon cycle, carbon is exchanging all around in the Earth system. It's in rocks, and it's in the ocean, and it's in the atmosphere, and it's in plants and us and all sorts of forms. But what matters for warming is the greenhouse effect. And so it matters how much of that carbon happens to be in the atmosphere at any particular time. Right now, we've got something like about 850 billion tons of carbon in the atmosphere. That's a really small amount compared to the carbon that's on the planet. We've got something like 40,000 billion tons in the oceans and maybe something like 50 million billion tons in rocks. But again, it's the atmospheric carbon that really matters. As I think your listeners probably know, if we didn't have an atmosphere at all, or if the atmosphere only contained the major constituents like nitrogen and oxygen, then Earth would be a lot colder. It'd be pretty much frozen. But those greenhouse gases that have carbon in the atmosphere are keeping us warmer than we otherwise might be. So it's the atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases like CO2 and CH4 that are warming the planet. And how they do that is basically Earth gives off infrared energy. And just like you and I, we all give off infrared energy. The chair I'm sitting in is giving off energy. Everything that has a temperature above absolute zero is giving off energy, and it's dependent on its temperature. Earth happens to give off a range of wavelengths of energy that's in the infrared. Just like the sun, which is a lot hotter than the Earth, gives off wavelength ranges that are in the visible, which most people know about. So the Earth is sitting here giving off infrared radiation, and there are gases in the atmosphere that have molecular structures such that they can absorb those wavelengths of radiation and then re-emit them. And it takes a particular kind of molecular structure to do that. And CO2 and CH4 and water vapor are three of the big ones that are able to do that. So what happens is a photon comes off the Earth's surface. It gets absorbed. If it's the right wavelength, it gets absorbed by a greenhouse gas. That greenhouse gas then re-emits it, and it re-emits that photon in some random direction, because greenhouse gases don't have a sense of direction. And so that photon could go upward, it could go downward, it could go sideways. It very likely would go and get absorbed by another greenhouse gas and then get re-emitted in another random direction. And eventually these photons, some of them are going to make their way back down to the Earth's surface and get reabsorbed. So that's an addition of energy getting to the surface and therefore causing warming. Or they're going to eventually make their way out to space. All right, so we've got energy coming in from the sun. We've got energy leaving from space. If those two things balance out, which over time they generally do, then we've got an equilibrium temperature happening. The greenhouse effect is essentially keeping some of that energy in the Earth system for longer, and so we end up with a warmer planet than we otherwise would have. So it's really the characteristics of particular gases in the atmosphere that can absorb and re-emit radiation that the Earth's surface happens to give off.
So maybe we should talk a little bit about the carbon cycle.
Okay.
So how does exactly carbon get cycled around?
Lots of different ways. So the basic carbon cycle that involves the atmosphere in the short term is exchanged with the biosphere. So photosynthesis, plants take up CO2 out of the atmosphere when they're growing. And then when they die, they decay and they release that CO2 back to the atmosphere. So plants and respiration by plants and animals, those are two big ways in which CO2 comes and goes from the atmosphere. And that happens in a big way on an annual cycle. There's also gas exchange with the ocean. That's another short-term exchange that matters quite a lot for us. So there's constantly bombardment of CO2 molecules bouncing around in the atmosphere, hitting the surface of the ocean. And if the partial pressure of CO2 on one side of that boundary is higher than on the other side of that boundary, then we'll get a flux of CO2 molecules across it. In some places on Earth, that flux is from the ocean into the atmosphere. And then in some places, it's from the atmosphere into the ocean. Depends on the conditions in that particular location. But on average, with natural processes, those would balance over time. So, you know, we've got something like 90 gigatons of carbon exchanging between the atmosphere and ocean every year, and we've got something like 120 gigatons of carbon exchanging with the plants and the soils and the atmosphere every year. So there's these vast exchanges going on. Some bits of carbon get buried For example, they might get buried in the ocean sediments on the bottom of the ocean. Those will eventually make their way into rocks. And that's really where the vast storage of carbon is in rocks. And that carbon comes out of rocks and goes into rocks very slowly, but that's where the major reservoir is. Fossil fuels are, of course, one particular kind of special reservoir, which really just means that the carbon has gotten concentrated enough that humans can economically extract it from the rocks.
So I've heard quite a range of estimates about how long CO2 stays in the atmosphere. I've heard as little as 5 years to as many as thousands of years. I've heard that methane is 20 times more potent than CO2 in warming the planet, and I've heard that it's 100 times more potent. And then there are the various claims made about the other greenhouse gases. And frankly, it's all gotten a bit blurry in my head. So can you help straighten me out? Like, what is the meaning of these numbers anyway? And are there certain numbers that we should be carrying around in our minds as a way of thinking about this?
Yeah, there are two basic questions there. One has to do with how long CO2 stays in the atmosphere, which is one question. And then there's this other one, which you mentioned about methane being more potent than CO2. So this is called global warming potential of different gases. So the range of estimates for how long CO2 stays in the atmosphere, I think, comes from two different ways of thinking about it. So I was just talking about how much carbon exchanges with the ocean every year and how much exchanges with the plants and soils every year. So total, every year going out of the atmosphere, we have something on the order of 200 billion tons of carbon going out of the atmosphere into the ocean and plants. And we've got also 200 coming back out into the atmosphere. And total, our sort of stock of carbon in the atmosphere is about 850 billion tons. So got 850 billion tons, 200 of that is getting exchanged every year. So that's why someone might come up with a number like 4 to 5 years is the average sort of residence time of a molecule of CO2 in the atmosphere. But that's not really very useful or very important, because it's not like we could just then shut off one of those valves. For example, let's keep the valve that takes CO2 out of the atmosphere into the ocean, but not let any back out. That's not going to work. So even though individual molecules are exchanging, the total stock of carbon in the atmosphere is what really matters. And so to draw that down takes a much longer time than these quick annual kinds of exchanges. So, you know, we've been putting about 10 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere through human activities every year. And so that's 10 billion on top of what is getting exchanged naturally. And on average, about half of that, about 5 billion of the excess carbon we're emitting, gets naturally taken up by the oceans and by plants and soils. So they're doing us a huge favor by essentially taking out about 50% of what we put in every year. But that extra 50% is staying in the atmosphere. So let's just say at some time in the future, we are going to stop putting carbon into the atmosphere. At that point, our emissions will go to zero. We'll have some concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere that's higher than today. The real question is, how long does it take to draw that down? And that is a longer timescale process. So initially, it's going to go into the ocean, right? Contributing to ocean acidification, which is already happening on a large scale, a measurable scale, and causing problems for marine organisms. The really long scale drawdown is going to take up to hundreds of thousands of years. And that drawdown actually has to happen through slow rock weathering processes. So geologic kind of timescales is what we're talking about. And we know those timescales mostly by looking at records from the past. One pretty famous example is a record from 55 million years ago at the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum. And this was an event in which a lot of carbon got released to the atmosphere fairly quickly. And fairly quickly is probably on the order of several thousand years. So actually probably slower than what we're doing now. And we can look at what the geologic record says about that. And we see this perturbation, this spike increase. And then we see how long it takes to go back to something that might look like background. And that took, you know, between 100,000 and 200,000 years. So I think in terms of timescales, yes, someone could say, well, the residence time of an average CO2 molecule or carbon atom in the atmosphere is 4 or 5 years, but that's not very meaningful. What's really meaningful is the time scale that it's going to take to draw down atmospheric CO2 from the peak that we're going to eventually reach. That was the first part of the question. The second part of your question has to do with global warming potential. When people say things like methane is 20 times more potent than CO2, and these are really squirrely numbers, I think they're hard to get your head around. And it really depends on a few different things that are hard to understand. One thing it depends on is the initial concentration of the greenhouse gas. And concentrations of these greenhouse gases are changing over time. So this is why global warming potential estimates are actually changing over time. One of the reasons. Another thing that matters is how good each gas is at absorbing and emitting infrared radiation. So is it absorbing wavelengths that are right smack at the peak of what the Earth emits, or are they off in the tails and not so important? And another thing that matters is what happens to each gas over time. Really, these global warming potentials and these comparisons, what we're trying to say is if we emit, for example, a ton of methane into the atmosphere, and we look at how much that changes the greenhouse effect over, say, a 20-year time horizon or a 100-year time horizon, how does that greenhouse effect from that ton of methane compare to a situation in which we emit a ton of CO2 instead? So CO2 is the comparator gas. So it always has a global warming potential of one, because if you compare it to itself, then it's one.
Right.
So the thing about greenhouse gases that a big part of this is that the higher the initial concentration of the greenhouse gas, the less bang for your buck you're going to get. So the increase in the greenhouse effect doesn't go up linearly with every molecule added, but it goes up with every doubling. So if we increase the CO2 concentration from, say, 100 to 200 parts per million, right, we're adding 100 parts per million, that gets us an extra about 4 watts per meter squared, which are the energy units we use in climate science, for that doubling. To get another 4 watts per meter squared, we actually have to go all the way up to 400, right? So we have to double again. We have to add twice as much the next time to get the same warming. So the higher you go, the less warming you get for each additional molecule. And the analogy that I sometimes use in my class is like baseball outfielders, right? So typically you have three and you can catch some number of fly balls because those folks can cover the area in some way, right, with the three of them. If you add a fourth, you're probably going to do quite a bit better, right? You added one from three to four and you're really probably going to catch more fly balls. But say you had 100 of them and then you added one more outfielder, like it's really not going to make much of a difference.
Right.
So it's the same kind of thing with greenhouse gases. So right now, adding a molecule of CO2, given the current CO2 concentration, is just less effective than adding a molecule of methane. So there's that, because they're starting at different initial concentrations. CO2 has an absorption band that's quite nicely positioned close to the middle of the range of wavelengths that the Earth gives off. And methane has a pretty good position as well, and it's just less saturated right now. The other thing that really matters is what happens to the gas over time, right? So methane isn't particularly stable in the atmosphere. So after about a decade or so, it will actually oxidize and become CO2, right? So it's got a decade of being methane, and then it's got a much longer lifetime being CO2. So all of these things have to get combined, and estimates come out like, you know, methane is 20 times more potent than CO2. But it also, again, it depends on that time horizon, right? The shorter the time horizon, the more important methane is going to be. The longer the time horizon, the less important methane is going to be.
So with all the natural variability in climate, how do we even know that humans producing CO2 is in fact causing climate change now?
That's an excellent question. It's asked a lot. And there are a few different fingerprints that are human. And really, we don't have another explanation that's viable. One of those fingerprints has to do with burning fossil fuels. So fossil fuels come from plants, ultimately, either marine plants or land plants. And plants, when they photosynthesize, they take up one particular isotope of carbon more preferentially than others. So there are a couple of different isotopes of carbon that are stable. And those of you who remember chemistry from way back when, carbon-12 is the common garden variety of carbon. And there's also a stable form of carbon that's carbon-13. It's got an extra neutron. But they're both stable. They're not radioactive. They're around. So plants like to take up carbon 12 better than carbon 13. And so what that means is that fossil fuels are enriched in this carbon 12. So what we can see over time is we can measure the ratio of isotopes in atmospheric CO2, and we can clearly see the signal that it's from fossil fuels. We're adding CO2 to the atmosphere from fossil fuels because we don't actually have another source of carbon that would have that signature with that excessive C12. So there's that chemical signature. Another chemical fingerprint has to do with oxygen. For example, when we're combusting fossil fuels, one thing that happens is that we're taking these things that are essentially carbon and hydrogen, and we're breaking them up, and we're combusting them, and we're sticking oxygen onto the carbon and making CO2, and that's the byproduct that goes away into the atmosphere. So that process is taking oxygen from the atmosphere to do that, and we have measurements over time that show the long-term trend is that atmospheric oxygen is going down in proportions that we would expect given what we know about fossil fuel burning that has happened so far. Those are a couple of chemical signatures that clearly link the increase in CO2 over the past century or so to human activities, in particular to fossil fuel burning. We have pretty good records because, you know, people keep business records about fossil fuels, right? How much coal got bought and sold? People don't hold on to their fossil fuels for very long. They buy them and they burn them. So we have a pretty good idea about how many fossil fuels and how many tons of carbon have been burned since the start of the Industrial Revolution. And that aligns pretty well with what we'd expect to happen to the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere if we were to burn those fossil fuels over time. Given, of course, also that, as I said before, some of that carbon ends up going into the oceans and back into land plants and soils. So those are a few observational lines of evidence that point to human activities. There's also a line of evidence that relies on modeling. And so the IPCC, I think, does this very well, summarizing suites of models. And essentially the cool thing about models is that you can turn things on and off and see what happens. And essentially, if we want to explain the temperature record of the 20th century, particularly the latter half of the 20th century, you can't do it without including human activities. If you just included natural variability, things like volcanoes and sunspots, you don't produce the temperature record. It's only with adding those human activities that we get a match to what the historical record actually shows. So those are a few.
Okay, but you mentioned a minute ago that there was a nonlinear relationship between the amount of CO2 that we're putting into the atmosphere and the temperature response. So what's the sensitivity there? Like, how good is our ability to estimate the influence of CO2 on warming, and how good are our estimates of that sensitivity aspect? And where do these carbon budget numbers even come from anyway?
So climate sensitivity, that is a million-dollar question. So essentially what climate sensitivity is trying to get at is, there are two ways of thinking about it. One is, if we double CO2, how much temperature change do we get once we let the Earth come back to an equilibrium temperature? So it's kind of the hypothetical scenario where we double CO2 all at once, and then we stop and we wait, and we see what the temperature turns out to be at equilibrium. So we know really quite well in terms of the energy budget, in terms of watts per meter squared. That doesn't necessarily translate into the average surface temperature. But the numbers that people have come back to again and again through modeling efforts or through looking at what's happened in the past, for example, we can look at what the forcing was during the last ice age compared to today, and we know what the temperature was during the last ice age compared to today, and we can then extrapolate a climate sensitivity, right? How much temperature change do we get if we change the energy budget? Well, these numbers converge on a central value that often is about 3 degrees of temperature change, that's in Celsius or Kelvin units, 3 degrees Celsius, if we double CO2, right? And if we doubled CO2 again, we get another 3 degrees Celsius temperature change. Now that's at equilibrium after we've sort of, the whole system has equilibrated. So climate sensitivity is a number that everyone would really like to know, right? In most sciences, what we're going to be looking at is a probability distribution, right? Where maybe 3 degrees Celsius per doubling is the central value, and there's a probability distribution around there. We have a pretty good idea that CO2 alone, just from the physics of CO2, means that the climate sensitivity is not going to go below, I'm going to get this number wrong, but somewhere around 1.5 degrees Celsius per doubling. The place where we have the most uncertainty is at the high end. So there is a chance that the climate sensitivity is actually quite a lot higher than 3 degrees per doubling. And that's sort of the scary part, right? The low end, we can contain quite well. The high end, harder to deal with, right? So there are, you know, things we don't know. Are there going to be some kind of tipping point in the climate system where we pass a threshold and that sort of sets some feedbacks in motion, some amplifying feedbacks in motion that would mean the temperature would go higher than we might anticipate? So it's an excellent question. It comes back to, you know, best estimates and ranges. 3 degrees per doubling is, you know, still probably not going to be a desirable future.
Okay, so if I'm still following all this, then I'm going to guess that where we're getting our carbon budgets from is we're going to look at what's the range of natural variability for the Earth to be within its relatively stable climate situation that it's been in during most of human existence, and that has a relationship to a certain amount of carbon in the atmosphere. And we know what the absorption capacity of the Earth is, and we know how much we're putting out. And so then we can just do the math based on those numbers and figure out how much we could continue to burn without falling out of the climate equilibrium that we're in now.
Yeah, that's the basic idea. So when you're talking about carbon budget, do you mean sort of how much more carbon we can burn?
Yeah, I think so.
So I really like the idea of thinking about carbon budgets and how much we might be able to burn for if we're aiming for some particular target or actually to avoid some particular threshold. People like Damon Matthews and Susan Solomon and Ray Pierre-Humbert have done some really great work helping people get their heads around this. So one really cool thing that came out was that the cumulative carbon that we emit, so cumulative meaning we start counting, say, from the start of the Industrial Revolution, and we count all the molecules of carbon that we've put into the atmosphere. There's a relationship, a linear relationship, between those cumulative carbon emissions and the equilibrium temperature change from those carbon emissions. So the estimate is that to increase the temperature about 2 degrees above pre-industrial values, the budget for that is something like 1,100 billion tons of carbon. All right, so that's kind of nice to think about because then we have a number and it's fairly straightforward. We can look at what we've already emitted, which is more than half of that budget already. And then we can look forward and say, oh, well, how much more can we emit? And then we really get into discussions of, well, that 1,100 gigatons, billion tons, is kind of for hitting 2 degrees above pre-industrial values, right? So that's kind of a 50% chance of going over it, a 50% chance of going under it. So if we want a better chance of staying under 2 degrees, or even a better chance of staying under 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial values, then we need to back off our cumulative carbon budget. I very much like that framing of it in terms of cumulative carbon budget. It gets away from some of the more complicated arguments about what we should be doing.
Okay, that's a helpful framing because I think there is an important difference between understanding what the science says and then figuring out what your policy prescription is, right?
Yeah.
And I do want to talk a little more about that later on, but I got a few more questions about the science I'd like to give you. So you have a background in paleoceanography. Can you briefly describe what that kind of science is about and how it can inform our understanding of the climate change phase we're in today?
Yeah, so paleoceanography, and I think of it really as paleoclimate. Paleoceanography would really be about trying to understand how the ocean works and how the ocean has worked in the past. The ocean is a pretty important aspect of the climate system. But what I was focusing on is looking at the records that are in deep sea sediments and trying to understand what had happened in the past in terms of the climate. These records essentially help us understand how the oceans have changed in the past, what's the range of natural variability. For example, how much ocean acidification has happened in the past? How does that compare to what's happening today? We can look at events like the one I mentioned before, the Paleocene, Eocene thermal maximum, and take a look at what we think happened during that time period, and then compare to what's happening today. We can reconstruct conditions on Earth for the last ice age and say, okay, well, how different was that from today? What I always find astonishing about that is that the last ice age was a time period when Canada was pretty much covered with ice. Large portions of Northern Europe were also covered, and life was really quite different. Yet, the global average temperature was really only about 5 or 6 degrees colder than it is today, even though the planet looked a lot different. And so when we talk about, you know, maybe 3 degrees by the end of the century, 4 degrees by the end of the century, like, that's huge, right? The difference between the ice age and today is maybe 5 or 6 degrees Celsius. So 5 or 6 degrees Celsius warmer than today is just, it's got to be a very different world.
Just for my clarity, which ice age are you talking about here?
The most recent one, about 20,000 years ago.
What about the Little Ice Age? I think that was the 19th century, recent one?
Yeah, 18th century. Spanned some period of time there. So the Little Ice Age, that was a period of time when temperatures were colder, particularly the records are for Europe, a little bit colder. What in particular?
Well, I remember there was a kind of a famous year without a summer, I believe.
Oh, the year without a summer. That actually was due to a volcanic eruption. That was from Krakatoa.
Okay.
But that's an important piece of the climate system, volcanoes. They do just cool the climate for a few years by spewing all sorts of sulfate aerosols into the stratosphere that reflect incoming sunlight. So after Krakatoa, which was one of the biggest eruptions in the historical record, essentially the sunlight was blocked all around the world for a while. Crops failed, famine, etc.
And when was that again?
It was 1880, I think.
1880. Okay, so that's, you know, that was kind of in the same zone that I was thinking about of the Little Ice Age just a little later. So
yeah.
In the Little Ice Age, as I recall, we do have some historical record of, again, famines in Europe. The people had difficulty raising crops. People migrated to find a more acceptable climate, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think I have a lot to say about that. It's not a very big, in terms of average global temperature, it's not a very big change. But as you point out, it had a big impact on people. And I think maybe that's one fundamental lesson to take away, is that even a small average climate change really can impact people's livelihoods.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So for 7 years, you were a chief scientist at Sea Education Association in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, where you sailed thousands of miles with undergraduate students doing research. So what kind of research were you doing there?
Yeah, SEA, Sea Education, is just this great organization that takes undergraduates out to sea. They have two sailing schooners. They're about 40 meters long. And they're also, each of these schooners is an oceanographic research vessel, and it's very well equipped. So what I was doing was working with students. They would write proposals for what they wanted to study in our 6-week voyage. And we would go out and do that work. So it was all undergraduate student research. It was ranging from things like the distribution of eel larvae to studying the equatorial Pacific currents to looking at sediment variability in time and space to looking to the distribution of plastic and tar balls in the surface ocean. Some of this SEA has actually put together over the years and published, and I would say in particular the plastics research is pretty amazing. They've got a record of plastic from the Atlantic, North Atlantic, and Caribbean that goes back to the early 1970s, which is a data set unlike anything anybody else has. So it really depended. They were biological, chemical, physical, geological projects. It was wonderful for me because I got a chance to expand into areas that I previously hadn't studied. I don't know a whole lot about biology, so my focus had more been in the geology and physical sciences.
Right. Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. I mean, I guess the reason I was mentioning it is because I wanted to understand a little better what the science of oceanography can tell us. So, you know, there's impacts of the climate on the oceans, as we discussed a moment ago, like ocean acidification. But there's also coral bleaching, and we've heard a lot in the news lately about how the Great Barrier Reef is dying. And all of that sounds pretty bad, but what does it mean to all of us landlubbers?
That depends. Personally, I think it's quite important. One thing that oceanography can tell us about is how biological communities are changing. So just like in the last ice age on land, you know, Canada now is covered with a forest. Well, it was covered with an ice sheet before, so all those trees had to move somewhere. So just like on land, when climate changes and organisms have to migrate or expire, in the ocean as well, organisms are migrating and going to different places trying to find different conditions that are conducive to what is good for them. So oceanography can tell us how those patterns are changing. In terms of the coral reefs, and particularly the Great Barrier Reef, yeah, coral bleaching events there and around the world have become more prominent, more common, more frequent. And corals themselves can't really move. There's also an issue of sea level rise, depending on how fast sea level rise happens. Some corals would be able to keep up with sea level rise, some would not. So I think they're kind of a bit of a, I don't want to say thermometer, but they're a bit of a metric for us, right? So they're communities that are surviving just kind of on the edge of the conditions that they can take. And when ocean conditions go beyond the range that they're capable of surviving in, that community is going to suffer. So it is showing up quite prominently in coral reef communities with ocean temperature warming, and it shows up in other places where different organisms are distributed differently than they would have been. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that those corals can't recover. There certainly have been bleaching events, and corals have recovered from that. I think it just remains to be seen whether if the hot events that are causing the coral bleaching just become too frequent for those communities to reestablish themselves.
Okay, well, I mean, I guess what I'm hearing is ocean acidification and coral bleaching are sort of indicators of the changing climate and changing temperatures. But what's the importance of that? I mean, aside from, you know, we'd like to have corals and we'd like to have healthy oceans. But aside from that, what does it mean? Is there an impact on the food chain? Are there feedback effects that we need to be aware of here? I mean, what does it really mean?
What does it mean? That's an excellent question. I think for, in terms of the human food chain, we've probably changed what's happening in the ocean through fishing quite a lot. So, you know, we've been changing the types of organisms that we fish for as we gradually kind of fish out different desirable species and start to fish for less desirable species. You know, what does it ultimately mean, say, if the coral reefs disappear? We would be losing that diverse community in the ocean. What would that change? I don't actually know the specifics of what that would change, what would take over. We have seen places in which coral reefs turn into algae-dominated ecosystems with less diversity of organisms. Are those communities just as resilient as the coral reefs? Are they just as productive? I think you probably would have to get somebody else on here to talk more specifically about that.
Okay. Yeah. So much of your work is focused on teaching people about climate change. And in addition to your teaching at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, you have a self-paced free online course on the subject, as well as a 2014 book titled Understanding Climate Change, in which you and your co-author Sarah Birch explain the basics of the climate system, climate models and prediction, and human and biophysical impacts, as well as strategies for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, enhancing adaptability, and enabling climate change governance. So, you clearly look at climate change as not just another physical system issue, but as one with many connections to human health and poverty and other environmental problems. Conversely, one of the main reasons I created this show was to explore energy transition as a response to climate change. And I guess, you know, the way I think about it, it's all about energy transition ultimately. But perhaps you see climate change in a broader context.
I definitely agree that mitigation is about a transition to a carbon-free energy system. I mean, that's getting at the core of the problem, and that's the main solution, right? How do we get there? You know, there are changes to other parts of our human systems as well, agriculture and forestry and things like that. But you're right. Yeah, getting to a carbon-free energy system is the root of the problem. I think that the human issues you list are really about why should we try to make this transition? And also then how, governance issues and things like that. I would say for the how, my colleague Sarah Birch would be much more positioned to talk about that. In terms of why, though, that's going to be personal for people. You know, why should we address climate change? In my opinion, it's really critical to addressing large-scale human suffering. And I want to live in some kind of society that's humane. Right? So extreme events, which are becoming more common with warming temperatures, are just super disruptive, both to individual people and to communities. And human communities are going to thrive better in a more stable kind of climate. I mean, just for an example, close to home, as I'm sure you know, last year about 90,000 people fled Fort McMurray, Alberta, because of massive wildfires there.
Yeah.
Lots of the city burned. It was a huge disruption to those people. And that's that's just a drop in the bucket, really, compared to the people who were already on the move due to climate change from sea level rise, for example, and compared to probably how many people will be on the move due to sea level rise or drought or flooding. So how do we mitigate enough so that we can try to avoid as much disruption to people as we can?
Yeah.
You know, in terms of the how, I think it's clear it's going to take effort at a lot of different levels. And I am really heartened to see in the U.S., city governments, county governments, state governments stepping up and making commitments to acting on mitigation and changing the energy system, just like your show is really about. You know, even if the federal government in the U.S. isn't, I'm pretty hopeful that people at all levels will take that initiative and we'll get somewhere over time.
Yeah, me too. So you clearly have a passion for teaching about climate change and not just for conveying the scientific information to students, but for really focusing in on the teaching process itself and understanding how people learn, understanding where their perceptions go wrong, and teaching things like systems dynamics. I'm curious why you shifted from a focus on the science itself to a focus on how it's taught. What was your motivation for that? And, you know, what do you hope to achieve with your current work?
Yeah, I think the big picture answer is that I'd like to do work that contributes, again, toward our working to have sustainable human communities and humane communities. I think that I personally can do that better by facilitating learning than I can through doing paleoceanographic research, which is where I started in my career. I think that giving people opportunities to practice reasoning from evidence and to practice scientific thinking will go toward our having human communities where people value decisions that are informed by the best available information. And I'd like to live in a scientifically literate society, and I don't mean to disregard other pieces of information that go into decision making, but I think science is a part of it, and it's an important aspect of individual and community decision making success. There are other things that are super important in communities, the arts, for example, many other things. Science has been my primary focus.
So what, you know, in your teaching efforts, what are some of the main concepts that you find that students misunderstand? And how do you overcome those misunderstandings?
I think there are a few that stand out. One is systems dynamics. It just is really not intuitive to think about what happens to a stock of something, like the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, over time, given that there's stuff flowing in and there's stuff flowing out. And sometimes those flows in and out are not balanced. And it's just so anti-intuitive, you know, and this is just looking at stocks and flows and not even getting into feedbacks, which add a whole layer of complication. John Sturman and some other people working with him have evidence from years of work that most of us, just humans, the way we think, we erroneously rely on intuitive thinking, and our thinking about systems dynamics is just wrong. For example, most people think that if we could just level off the amount of our emissions every year, just let's just stop now, we'll keep it the same this year and next year and next year. They think that if we level that off, then the total amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere will also level off. And it's just not true, as long as there's more CO2 going into the atmosphere than is coming out. And so, you know, how do we get people to think about that? Well, we give them examples and we give them opportunities to fail, to commit to an answer that's the intuitive wrong answer, and then have to go back and switch to their non-intuitive thinking, the harder thinking, and figure out how this system really works. It's really hard to get your head around. I don't think that many people have a really instantaneous grasp of systems dynamics. It's something you have to think through carefully. The greenhouse effect is tough for people. I think mostly it's because it's been pretty solidly misrepresented in media, from textbooks to news reports. But, you know, it is fundamentally really a systems dynamics problem too. It's about flows of energy in and out and stocks of energy. How much energy is there in the atmosphere? One thing that seems to help people overcome issues with the greenhouse effect is to actually talk about the behavior of greenhouse gas molecules and what those greenhouse gases actually do. And this helps people get away from some ideas, for example, that the ozone layer has something to do with it, or that it's about incoming sunlight, or that there's some layer in the atmosphere that photons are bouncing off of. So we've shown in some classes that if we teach people about the molecular behavior of these gases, then they have an easier time replacing in their own mental models those erroneous ways of thinking about the greenhouse effect. You know, fundamentally, if people misunderstand the greenhouse effect scientifically, I don't think that's fundamentally a huge problem. You could understand that increasing greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is associated with warming, and that certainly could be enough for someone to decide to take action or influence a decision. But understanding how it actually works will make you a little bit less susceptible to someone challenging your ideas about the greenhouse effect. I gotta say, one of my favorite misunderstandings is about carbon dioxide and ice sheets, which I didn't know about until a few years ago, but then it seems to keep coming up with students. And the idea here is, the misunderstanding here is that when ice sheets melt, they release CO2. So this is what people think. And I think there are at least two possible sources for this misunderstanding. The first one is that some people have learned that there are records of past CO2 concentrations. If we look in ice sheets, we can find little bubbles of former atmosphere, and we can measure the CO2, and we can go back in time and create this record of CO2. It's what Al Gore showed in his movie, The Inconvenient
Truth. Right, the ice core samples.
The ice core samples. So there's this idea that there's CO2 in those ice cores. And so if we melt the ice, then that CO2 is going to come out. Right? So what people are saying is they think there's a whole bunch of CO2, when in fact it's these little tiny bubbles. And the CO2 that's in there, just little samples of the previous atmosphere. So in fact, the previous atmosphere had lower CO2 concentrations than today's. Right. And so if anything, this tiny amount of gas coming out is going to dilute today's atmosphere. So I find that one pretty interesting. I think the other source maybe of that misunderstanding is people may be conflating ice sheets and permafrost. And certainly as the permafrost heats up and warms, it does release both CO2 and methane. So, but those are kind of my favorites.
Yeah, well, I could totally see that. I mean, I've read an awful lot of really bad coverage on climate in the mainstream media for the past decade or more. It doesn't really surprise me that people get confused by it.
No.
So one of the things that really jumped out at me from our previous conversations with climate researchers is this key problem of communicating long-term consequences to people who are mainly thinking about their day-to-day lives. They think in short-term. And researchers like Dan Kahan and Daniel Kahneman have articulated this problem very nicely about how humans seem to be wired to overestimate the importance of the present and underestimate the importance of the future. And it seems to me that this disconnect between these long time cycle issues that we'd confront in the climate change dialogue as compared with the very short time scale of things that we can do anything about or that we do in our daily lives, that mismatch is a real problem in terms of educating about climate. Mm-hmm. So what do you think we can do about that?
Boy, I wish I knew the answer to this one. What can we do about it? Whew. Well, one thing, we have to keep talking about it, right? We have to keep letting people know and talking to ourselves as well about how humans are and how we don't really act very much in the thinking about the long term. We mostly act in the short term. And this is in our daily and yearly and decadal individual lives and community lives. I think it's a hugely difficult problem, you know, not just for the biological reasons that Dan Kahneman has articulated, but the way that our politics are set up, right? The election cycles are too short. And so governments don't necessarily have the desire to try to make something happen that's going to be longer term than their term in office. Right. So how do we deal with that? We just have to keep bringing it up. We have to keep it in the forefront and keep reminding ourselves of the types of creatures that we really are. I think Dan Kahan's work has, you know, he's got this work that shows that people become more polarized the more they learn, like the more scientifically literate they are, the more polarized they are about climate science. One thing he didn't do, though, he didn't actually test them on their climate science knowledge. He tested on sort of general numeracy and science literacy. So that doesn't seem to necessarily hold true if you test people on climate science knowledge. So, I mean, it would be extraordinarily depressing to me if learning about climate science made people stronger deniers in general, right? But I don't think that's true.
You know, I often wonder what it must be like to know what you know and to look at the world with that understanding about all the different scenarios of our possible futures and all the variables that will determine it, both known and unknown, and to grapple with the hard scientific understanding on the one hand, and then this whole squishy beast of politics and beliefs and wishes and denials and human foibles and learning and all that on the other. How do you navigate that as a teacher, mentally and emotionally?
It can be really hard. I have found over the years of teaching climate science that just the fact that I have to keep updating the data to, you know, oh, it was 385 parts per million. Oh my gosh, now we're up above 400. You know, just to see that go by and recognize the time that's gone by and really how short a time I've been teaching climate science and how quickly things have changed. It's hard to get your head around. And I think it actually is just goes directly back to Dan Kahneman's work, right? It's like these things are changing sort of under our noses and we're not really noticing because they're not a baseball bat coming to hit us in the head.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes I certainly have found it depressing. I think that the challenge that I see as a teacher is to try to convey to students that there are things you can do, that governments actually do have quite a lot of power to make decisions that can influence our carbon emissions, that can influence our energy system. You know, approving a pipeline or not approving a pipeline has a big impact in Canada, and they can influence those decisions. And getting politically involved, sort of thinking about it for the long term, is something that they can do. Mostly people start to think about individual actions, you know, taking the bus and biking and eating vegetarian, and those are all individual things that can help. I think it's more empowering to think that you could influence decision making at a governmental level. Also, I try to convey to students that these problems aren't yet solved. There are ideas out there about how to deal with this problem, but we haven't figured it out at scale. So for people who are interested in partial technological solutions, we have a lot of engineering students. You know, if one of them could figure out how to suck CO2 out of the atmosphere at scale and store it somewhere, like, go for it.
Yeah.
Go do that, because that would be
that.
Awesome. But we just don't have that yet, right? There are little, there are small scale things in, you know, that experiment in Iceland where they got CO2 to kind of turn into a solid form, but not in the billions of tons that we need to have happen if that's going to be a contributor to the solution. Anyhow, so I don't have data that shows that my students are inspired to go out and take action on climate change if they would want to. The only thing that I can do is to try to give them an idea that they can be part of the solution. That it's not this hopeless thing that's just marching its way toward the cliff.
Well, if you think the best thing you can do is to inspire your students and fill them with hope, then you have to be able to deal with your own feelings about it. Like, you can't inspire people to be hopeful when you're horribly depressed.
That's true. That's really hard
yeah.
for anybody.
You know, I guess I just wanted to ask you then, what's your best guess for what kind of a climate future we're actually going to have? You know, however you want to frame that.
Well, as you mentioned, there are a lot of variables. You know, some
scenarios.
Some are really key. You know, the energy transition, that's your focus. That's super important. How fast and to what extent is that going to happen? So, you know, maybe that'll happen fast. If we think about the Montreal Protocol, for example, as the beginning of transitioning away from refrigerants that were taking out the ozone layer. After that, a lot of other meetings and agreements were made. And, you know, the Montreal Protocol on its own wouldn't have solved the problem, but all those follow-up meetings and agreements actually, you know, made it so we sort of avoided that bullet. So it depends on how much happens in terms of follow-up conversations and agreements after the 2015 Paris Agreement. So that was a start. Those commitments, if they actually come to fruition, are going to get us to 3.5 degrees above pre-industrial values, right? It's not good enough. So will the international community, with support from local governments and state-level governments and nation-level governments, will people actually fulfill those commitments and actually not just fulfill those, but do better as time goes on and make stronger commitments? I like to hope that we will. I think the example of the ozone problem makes it seem possible that that was a series of agreements that went into place. That was a much easier problem than changing the entire energy system. I'm not going to kid myself that this is an easy problem. So what kind of future we're going to have, I don't know. I think it depends on what we decide to do. I bike to work every day. I bike on a road that's just a little bit above sea level. And I wonder, like, all the time, like, how many more years is this going to be my bike route? Because are they going to just abandon this road, or what's going to happen? I mean, and for the past 3 years, the city of Vancouver has preemptively sandbagged the road in the winter when high tides are combined with storm surge. You know, I don't think we're going to avoid a continued increase in extreme events, extreme flooding, droughts, heat waves, forest fires, storms. I mean, all of those are going to be destabilizing. I just hope that we are going to be able to act quickly enough that we can minimize that to the extent that we can. We're already looking at people migrating because of climate issues. Places that they're inhabiting are just not viable anymore. What's the range of possibility there? Can we keep that to a minimum? Because that's, again, just hugely disruptive, not only for those people who are moving, but also the people who are already in the places they're going to go.
Yeah. On maybe more of a hopeful note, I'd like to wrap this interview up with a question that I've asked several of my previous guests on climate science, and it's about how you would invest in new scientific studies right now if you had the budget to do it. So what would you do with a $20 million budget? What would you do with a $100 million budget? And what would you do with a $1 billion budget?
Investing in scientific research. Let's see. Boy, that's a lot of money. We could probably get that if we just switch the priorities of the U.S. government.
Yeah, we could.
Well, I'm going to stick to what I do. Perhaps this is a selfish thing, but...
Well, you got to go with what you know.
I would invest any one of those budgets in education. Because education is going to determine the types of decisions that we make in the future. We know a lot about the climate system. I'm not saying let's not keep learning about the climate system. Certainly, let's not, like... cut the NASA observing system or anything like that.
Right.
But right now, educating people is really important, and it takes a long time and a lot of money to change vast education systems where millions of people are involved. And there's been an effort, for example, in the US to put climate science forefront with the Next Generation Science Standards. I think that effort is really super important to continue. If we have students coming out of just the public education system who are scientifically literate, who have an understanding of the climate system that's good enough, who are practiced at making decisions based on evidence, I think we've got a better future ahead of us. If we don't address education, then I think we're not looking at a very good decision-making future.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think we could easily use $1 billion, probably more than that.
Okay. We're going to get out there and make it so. That's what we're going to do.
Okay.
Thank you, Sarah, very much for being on the show. I appreciate you taking the time to share your knowledge with us. This was really fun.
You're welcome. I had a great time.
That was Dr. Sarah Harris of the University of British Columbia. One idea that really stuck with me from this interview was how much effect a slight change in global average temperatures can have on the global climate. When we hear that we need to keep warming below a 2-degree threshold, I think most people have an idea of what that means. We'll be able to survive without massively disruptive effects. But I don't think most people understand that 4 or 5 degrees, plus or minus, can mean the difference between, say, an ice sheet covering most of Canada, or equatorial regions so hot that no one can stand to live there. But as her teaching experience shows, climate scientists have a lot of work to do in overcoming basic misunderstandings. I had no idea that so many people think that the CO2 trapped in melting ice is a contributor to global warming, for example. Yikes. If people are still struggling with such basic concepts, then maybe it's time to rethink how we're communicating climate science, because what we're doing clearly isn't working very well. Especially in light of the insights about motivated reasoning and automatic thinking that the work of people like Kahan and Kahneman has revealed. I don't claim to have the answers here, but it does seem to me that a more comprehensive approach to teaching climate science, perhaps starting with the basic physics of molecular movements and energy exchange, as Sarah has done, is needed here. Instead of waiting until high school before teaching basic physical science and chemistry, maybe we need to be teaching it sooner and ensuring that students understand the carbon cycle. After all, it's one of the most fundamental and important aspects of how our planetary ecosystem functions. But, like basic energy literacy, our current educational system is set up in such a way that it's entirely possible to graduate from college without knowing anything at all about it. Given the potential urgency and risk of climate change, as Sarah pointed out, we could be in for some very disruptive futures. We're going to need a lot more people who understand the basics of climate change in the future if they're going to have any hope of managing the changes they are likely to face.
Lord, here comes the flood. We will say goodbye to flesh and blood. If again the seas are silent in any still alive, it'll be those who gave their island to survive. Drink up, dreamers, you're running dry.
And now a quick look at some recent news items. Item 1. The NordLink interconnector project, the first transmission interconnection between Germany and Norway across the North Sea, will go ahead with the announcement that the European Investment Bank will loan Norwegian operator Statnett 300 million euro for the completion of the 1.4 gigawatt line. Back in April, the EIB also agreed to provide TenneT, a transmission system operator on the German side, with a separate 350 million euro loan for the same project. The NordLink is a bipolar, high-voltage, direct-current HVDC link, 624 kilometers or 388 miles long, with an estimated total cost of about 1.2 billion euro. The NordLink is considered a project of common interest in the priority corridor of the North Sea's offshore grid project that we discussed in episode 34, and will enable Germany to import low-cost hydropower from Norway and wind power from Denmark. Item 2. Norway continues to push the leading edge in electric vessels. Last October, Plan B Energy Storage, or PBES, a Norwegian maker of battery storage technologies for hybrid and full electric commercial marine vessels, announced that it would provide 4 megawatt-hour battery packs to power the main propulsion of the two largest battery-powered ferries in the world. The Norwegian companies Norled and Siemens developed the world's first electric-powered car ferry, which began commercial operations in May 2015. And since Norway is the world leader in EV adoption, I think we can assume that a fair number of electric vehicles travel on this electric ferry. Now the Norwegian shipping company Kongsberg Gruppen ASA has announced the world's first fully electric and autonomous container ship. Starting in the second half of 2018, the ship will deliver fertilizer from Yara's production plant in Porsgrunn to the ports of Brevik and Larvik. Those are still fairly short distances, about 10 and 30 miles away by ship, respectively, so this isn't a replacement for long-haul ocean-going ships. But it will reduce Yara's diesel-powered truck haulage by 40,000 journeys a year, and I think the mere fact that electric, autonomous container ships are about to become a reality is a very significant milestone. Item 3. According to the BP Statistical Review released in June, world coal production dropped by a record amount in 2016. Coal consumption fell to a 6-year low in China and a low not seen since the 1970s in the U.S. BP chief economist Spencer Dale attributed the decline to a greater use of natural gas and renewable energy and to policy shifts away from coal. Item 4. India's new stringent emissions rules may force the closure of 40 gigawatts of coal power plants because they can't afford to implement required emissions control technologies. That's roughly equivalent to the amount of coal-fired power the Central Electricity Authority expects to be installed through 2027. So the best case for India's coal sector over the next decade is that it will remain flat. But considering that today's solar projects in India are about one-third cheaper than emissions-compliant coal plants, I wouldn't bet on even that. And finally, item 5. Japanese trading houses, including companies like Mitsubishi, are bailing out of their investments in coal for power generation, prompting some to declare that peak coal demand is upon us. They're a little late in saying so, as listeners to this show know, but it is encouraging that the thermal coal sector has lost its luster in the commodity trade. Well done, Mitsubishi. And oh, by the way, Australia and Indonesia and West Virginia, you might want to redouble your efforts to diversify your economies. Your days as kings of coal are coming to a close. Before we go, thanks as always to you, our loyal subscribers, for your support. This show literally could not exist without you. I hope that you are all checking out our new transcript feature, because I think it's a great new addition to our offering for subscribers. It allows you to click in the text or in the audio player to jump to that point in the audio and the transcript. We will typically upload transcripts a week or two after each show is published. I hope you're taking advantage of our show notes for each episode as well, which are a great resource for further explorations into the topics we cover on the show. The show notes include all the resources I consulted in preparing for each show and links to all the news items. I even hide a little Easter egg in them once in a while too, just to see if you're on your toes. Also, I'm pleased to note that several university classes have taken advantage of our offer to subscribe their students to the show at an unbeatable educational discount. So if you're an educator and thinking that it would be useful to make the Energy Transition Show available to your students, just drop us an email and we'll get you set up. I just love knowing that smart young students interested in energy transition and climate change are taking advantage of our hard work to stay at the cutting edge. As always, thanks to all of you who write to share your feedback on the show and your suggestions for future shows. I love getting those emails, so please keep them coming. To reach me with show feedback or ideas, or to inquire about our educational discount, just use the comment form on any show page or email me directly at chris@energytransitionshow.com. And finally, help us find new listeners by telling your friends and colleagues about the show. People like you aren't easy to find, so we depend heavily on word of mouth to build our subscribership. And thank you for spreading the word. Well, that's it for this episode of the Energy Transition Show. Thanks for listening. You can find our show archive and give us feedback and suggestions at energytransitionshow.com and follow us on Twitter at Transition Show. Our theme music was by Mike Sugar and Mark Burnfield, who you can find online at mikesugarmusic.com. The Energy Transition Show is a production of the XE Network.